Welcome to the Urban Complex, a system of interrelated, emotion-charged ideas, feelings, memories, and impulses. This name takes the definition and lays out what a listener should expect. A podcast where ideas, feelings, and memories collide, leading towards meaningful change. I'm co-host Chris Richardson. Please enjoy the journey with the Urban Complex. Smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow.
All opinions by Chris Richardson, Dominic Poppin, and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Arizona State University, the Arizona Department of Education, or the Arizona Commerce Authority. Any endorsement of or messages from sponsors are solely supporting the production of this podcast. There is no relationship further than podcast purposes with any sponsor unless separately created with another entity. Enjoy the Urban Complex. Smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow.
All right, Chris, here we are, another week for the Urban Complex podcast. What's top of mind for you?
Well, it'd be an understatement if I wasn't excited for our guest today. You know, a few weeks back, we had someone representing education in K-12 space, Superintendent Hoffman. She was amazing. She brought open kind of this new perspective of how can't be a smart city without an educated city. And I think just today's guest, Dr. Michael Crow, it's going to be this whole other perspective. Similarly, you can't be a smart city without an educated city. But I have a funny feeling he knows a lot about cities. And he also knows how to design. He calls himself a knowledge architect. And I think the way he will look at design and how to motivate cities to do more, I just think it's going to be amazing. So,
yeah, I'm really excited for this conversation. I think anyone that's followed what ASU has done under the leadership of Dr. Crow as the president, the transformation has been incredible. I mean, if you're wanting advice on how to lead an organization and transform it and innovate within it, I think this is going to be a fantastic story for a lot of our city leaders to listen to, and probably will have great advice for them as well.
Yeah, so. And I'm just really excited because I think, you know, we've talked about this before. We've had a couple guests literally call it out that cities haven't really changed. And I think he has been at the leading edge of changing the entire model for higher education with Arizona State University at the forefront. And I have a funny feeling he'll do something similar for city's trajectory based on what he's learned and experienced at ASU.
Yep, this is going to be fantastic. Should we bring him in?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go.
Support for this episode of The Urban Complex comes from Worldwide Technology.
What if we could connect people to new possibilities, turn thinking into a way forward, solve problems before they become a problem, and share the future with everyone? We can. At WWT, we connect businesses to technology to make the impossible possible, to reach better decisions faster, to accelerate progress. Together, let's make a new world happen.
All right. Dr. Crow, please let Dom and I give you a warm welcome to our podcast, The Urban Complex. Thanks for joining.
Happy to be here. Appreciate it.
Well, we've been doing this almost a year now, and we found that our audience loves to kind of get to know the guests. And so we just start with open-ended. Just tell us a little bit of information about you. Kind of give the podcast audience a little bit about you as a person and your background, and it really helps set the stage for what we'll talk about.
I'm really old, so you know, like, where do you start? But I was born into a Navy family. We moved all over the country. I went to 17 schools, give or take, before I graduated from high school. Actually 20, but depends how long you stayed. We moved 21 times. The longest place I ever lived in my entire life at the end of my freshman year in college was Kimball House, actually Spinney House, Friley Hall, Iowa State. So we lived all over the place in the U.S., enlisted family, pretty much working class, went to college, had a fantastic experience in college. I wanted to major in five things. They told me I could only major in one. I ended up majoring in two and minoring in three. So I majored in sort of political philosophy, environmental science, engineering. I think I would call the other one anthropology and linguistics. And so those were the things I was most interested in. And then ended up somehow on this track inside universities where I was really involved in building research centers, building research institutes, basically laying down all the track for Star Trek to become real. Ended up at Columbia University, where I became the chief research officer and the deputy provost there and a faculty member there, and learned a lot about entrepreneurism in New York City, being a part of all of our tech transfer stuff, hundreds of spin out companies, licenses, technologies, startups. University gave me, allowed me to keep $50 million a year of money that we earned from some things to invest in new initiatives. So I became really excited about being, you know, focusing on new kinds of technology initiatives, new kinds of intellectual initiatives, new kinds of educational initiatives. I realized along the way that the model of the elite university wasn't going to actually help the country to be successful. It was necessary but insufficient. And so started thinking a long time ago about how do you build a new kind of university. And then my wife got frustrated with me when I would get these offers to be presidents of other universities and then not take them. And everybody was all upset about that. So then I actually literally had a list that I wrote down in 2000 of the universities that I thought would be the coolest places to be president. So I wrote down three schools. Number one on the list of all places was ASU in Phoenix. Second on the list was CU Boulder in Metro Denver. And last on the list was University of Washington in Seattle. Mm-hmm. I thought Seattle had this innovative culture, and I thought the other two were still open country, meaning Arizona and Colorado were places that you could be an innovator and survive. And in Washington, you could be an innovator and maybe survive, Washington State. I didn't think you could get this done anywhere else. The job at Arizona State came open. Somehow I got picked, and that was 20 years ago. Wow. And so I've been hard at it since then. And so love Arizona, love everything about Arizona. Just happy to be here. Happy to make things happen.
That's an amazing story. I actually went to University of Washington, and the only other school I applied to was UC Boulder.
Yeah.
Kind of ironic. So I'm sure New York and Arizona are super similar. I'm sure Tempe and New York City are very similar. Help our audience understand what it is. What Arizona State University is and any key initiatives that you think are in context of this podcast, I think it really help people understand how different ASU is.
You know, I think what we've been, so Arizona is a new state. It's also a state in which there's still a huge amount of openness to new ideas. There's openness to new people. And so ASU is that. It's a new idea of what a public university can be. So we've designed a new public university model around the idea of entrepreneurship and enterprise. We're not relying on the government to build the university. We'll build the university. We'll operate the university. We'll advance the university. The government might want to help people to be able to attend the university, which they do, but they could help even more. And so we've taken this completely different model. How do you build a complete, hard-driving, highly innovative, continuously innovative public university to be able to be adaptive and agile and all those things. And that's what we've been able to do. So at ASU, we've got, for instance, in engineering, 10 years ago, we had 6,000 students in engineering. Now we have 27,000 students in engineering. We have more people studying philosophy and English than we've ever had. And then they're double majoring in everything that you can possibly imagine. We've taken our research to north of $700 million a year. So we're very excited about that. Without a medical school, that puts us in the top five or six schools in the whole world. We've got more research going on here outside of medicine than Stanford, than USC, than Cambridge, Oxford, Columbia, Harvard, any of those schools by a long shot. I mean, we left them all in the dust. And so the thing that people don't realize is that we've built this scaled thing, this massive university with 150,000 students, including our online degree-seeking students. That's also has the same level of research prowess as the most advanced research universities or most advanced institutes in the world, and is deeply committed to making Arizona work, to making these cities work, to being, you know, to transforming and to moving forward. So we've built this, what we call comprehensive university, all subjects, highly adaptive. We adjust to reality and desirous of being very impactful while at the same time being hugely egalitarian in terms of who we allow to come to the university. So we have this unbelievably diverse student body working at the leading edge of where we are as a species. And that's what we're doing at ASU.
Yeah, that's just so incredible. You know, and Dr. Crow, that's a perfect segue. You know, this podcast is about smarter cities or smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow. And it's been really fun being able to ask our guests what their view of a smart city is, because the, you know, the various perspectives that our guests bring, it's pretty enlightening to listen to about how people view smart cities. So please talk to us about your view of smart cities. What
you
are
know,
they?
You know, the smart, yeah, the smartest, thank you, Dom. The smartest cities will be those that whine the least.
Yeah.
Complain the least.
That's true.
Give up the least. And so there is nothing that isn't doable. You know, what we need now, for instance, is the design of cities which have, you know, unbelievable ability to manage their local and regional environment. They're worrying about clean water and clean air and, you know, the natural physicality that has to support the city. The city has to be seen. The smartness of the city is not just that it has a great electrical grid or a great public transportation system. You know, we can manage the local physical environment. You know, we can use plants and water systems and natural designs and carbon capture systems and renewable energy systems. And I'm not saying this just, you know, on the renewable energy kick, far from it. How do you build the city that works in this particular location? So, or whatever location you're in. So how do you build a living, adapting city? So if you took the model of Minneapolis and you said, I'm going to build that in the Sonoran Desert, well, then you're an idiot. if the streets look the same, if the buildings look the same, and we have too much of that now. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to apply the standard model of a city to this location.
Yep.
But this location is unique. Unique. We should have a completely different way that we're there should be unbelievable ability here to help enhance nighttime heat index from not going up. There should be very thoughtful engagement in terms of air purifying plant systems. There should be fantastic ways to try to control particulate matter. I'm just saying that smart means management of all things. And it means thinking and deciding and integrating across all of these things. And so what you're after is, in fact, we know this from the Center for the Future of Arizona's decadal poll on what do Arizonans want. They want, you know, jobs with dignity. They want to live in a healthy place. They want blue skies, clean water. They want localized food. So how do we start producing more food in the urban environment? So you could take this place that we live, this city, and it, smart means, you know, it's this naturally evolving, technologically enhanced social ecosystem that's addressing all these things. And oh, by the way, and people are making more money along the way on all of this. And there's more jobs being created on all of this. And there's more opportunity being created on all of this. Now, other cities sit around and they just whine. They just whine and complain. And they wait for people in Washington to solve their problems. That's all. There's no problem we can't solve here locally. None.
Hope isn't coming.
The what?
Hope is not coming.
No, it's just so weird. It's like somebody else give me a design that works in, you know, Madison, Wisconsin or Rochester, New York. Well, who cares?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
What we need is so, for instance, we're working on this reimagine the Rio Salado River, where you're going to take the entire 40 miles of the Rio Salado, the Salt River, as it flows through Metro Phoenix. And maybe like the Tempe Town Lake, maybe you'd build four of those and the rest would be these unbelievable riparian ecosystems as parks. And then they would manage water and flow and you'd plant those things and make those this unbelievable centerpiece of this massive city across 40 miles of this massive metro. You know, nobody else is doing that, but we need to do stuff like that because of the scale of this place. But you can't think in little small increments like other places. A smart city, to get to the root of your question, a smart city is one in which the city itself is designed in a way where life can be enhanced for everyone that lives there, not just some of the people.
That's tremendous. It's fantastic. And, you know, Dr. Kerr, you mentioned ASU as an enterprise. Talk to us a little bit more about what that means and how maybe public sector officials can start to think about that evolution for their cities and their communities.
Well, you know, it's kind of weird to me that a lot of people, when they are managing cities, they don't realize the full totality of their flexibility. So they operate as what I call simple bureaucracies. And simple bureaucracies are completely appropriate for certain kinds of things in the government. You want to run certain things in a certain way, on a certain schedule, with a certain team and a certain staff. But then how do we leverage our public assets and then operate certain things as public enterprises? So public enterprises, as is the case with ASU, are owned by the public, serve the public, receive a small amount of resources from the public, and then generate their revenue and their impact by operating to serve the market more broadly. And so a public enterprise, so for instance, I'll give you an example. So We think the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport, you know, has unbelievable potential as a public enterprise to take publicly reallocated land from the old Air Force base that was there to build an income generating piece of public assets related to, you know, the massive issues that we have in logistics, global logistics, regional logistics, and so forth. And so in England, Heathrow Airport, for instance, is run as a public enterprise. There's huge water projects run as public enterprises. And in many ways, the Salt River Project is a public enterprise. Well, that kind of thing, self-sustaining kind of thing, we need more of that throughout government, not less of that throughout government. So I think the openness here to smart city is smart in design also, smart in structure. So public enterprises are publicly purposed and operate entrepreneurially in ways in which the services are provided in ways in which it leverages all kinds of positive outcomes.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, this question is kind of going to build on that answer, but you know, you've literally helped create and kind of expand small cities like ASU itself, SkySong, and now the, you know, 335 acre development known as the Novus Innovation Corridor. So tell us, you know, about your approach to building and running these entities. What might be, you know, applicable to those in our audience that are running cities as well?
Well, so what we've tried to do in those projects is we run the university as a public enterprise with as many partnerships as we can build. We then have these four or five innovation campuses that we're taking property of the university or property that a municipality has given us to be able to advance. And what we're trying to do there is build through partnerships, public and private sector initiatives that create opportunities for new industries to emerge. And so what we're trying to do there is just lay down small catalytic locations, SkySong being one in Scottsdale, Novus being one in Tempe. We have the Polytechnic campus in East Mesa. We have the project that we're working on with the Mayo Clinic in North Phoenix. And we have the project that we're working on with the U of A and NAU and the City of Phoenix and Central Phoenix around the Phoenix Biomedical Campus. Those are all places in which through partnerships, we can make great things happen. So let's take the Phoenix Biomedical Campus. We got the Philadelphia R&D development company called Wexford to build their first spec research building in Metro, in Phoenix ever. First spec research building built in Arizona. Fabulous building in downtown Phoenix through a partnership between the city, us, and Wexford. That building now, private sector investment, is now advancing with multiple biotech spin-out companies, multiple entrepreneurship and innovation centers. And then that's going to lead to a new building that's going to have incubators in it for startup biotech companies. And so these are ways in which the private sector and the public sector come together to create the conditions from which new economies emerge. And a lot of people who are haven't really thought it through and don't know as much about the history of how new economies emerge don't realize that almost all new economic thrusts, whether it's the microchip industry or the you know, the electronics industry or whatever, all came from some kind of government private sector relationship. So what we've done is we've basically operated under the assumption that let's build places where more of that can happen. And we've built a bunch of them and lots of great things are happening. Hundreds of companies, thousands of workers. In fact, we're including the projects we've got going on in Novus, tens of thousands of workers that have all come in from the private sector to be near the university, to work with others, to partner with others, to be a part of these kinds of projects. So those are all our attempts at smart cities.
That's really interesting. You've referenced innovation a few times, innovation zones there, as well as design and kind of creating the space. Some of our audience may not know that ASU is now known for innovation. And I think innovation, when created as part of culture, can help be the catalyst for these types of changes. How did you make that happen at ASU? And how do you think a city might think about its own ability to create culture of innovation so that they can catalyze the change that you've referenced at this point?
Yeah, Chris, thanks. I hope most of the listeners can open up their brains. And so if you think that your job is just to run something, you should get another job. Because who wants to just run something? And so if you're the chief of a police department, if you're the city manager of a city, if you're the economic development leader of a city, if you're running, you know, a big intersector public agency like Valley Metro or something like that, if you're just running it, you're really missing the opportunity. So you need to be thinking about how you're going to stimulate into the organization the ability to continuously innovate. This is one of the mistakes that we make in government. You know, we think that the government's role is just to only implement some small service. Well, what if I could implement that same service at half the cost? What if I could implement that service and then lead to new businesses? You know, what if I could load robots onto the light rail and then the robots then go to different parts of the city and then deliver stuff to people using the public infrastructure to be able to do that? And so what I'm saying is, and we have robots on campus here delivering things all over ASU, all over all of our campuses. So the key to all of this is you have to build a culture open to innovation. And if you have managers that aren't open to innovation, they shouldn't be managers because you don't really need people not open to innovation. How could you not be open to innovation? We have this unbelievable opportunity to figure out how to do more with less, how to innovate, how to accelerate, how to make things happen. And so Chris and Dom, it really is the case of building a culture in which innovation is an expectation of everything that you do. And that means then in political governing of these things, our board, the Board of Regents, is very open to innovation and very open to creativity. And these other public governing boards need to also be open to innovation, which we don't see as much as we should in K-12, for instance. We don't see as much as we should in the governing of cities, in the governing of other public institutions. So let's take public incarceration. And so there's thousands and thousands of things that innovation would allow us to do to affect better outcomes, to lower the cost and so forth and so on. But the agencies and the groups have to be open to innovation, and you need to make that as a part of the culture.
And to ASU's benefit, for those that know, U.S. News and World Report has ranked ASU number one innovation now 7 years in a row. So pretty amazing what's put on there.
There's been a contest for 7 years, and thus far we've won all seven, which means now everybody's gunning for us, and so trying to knock us off.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing you referenced was research, and part of the ASU's charter is related to that research as well, and serving the broader community. What advice do you have for a city in partnering with universities to advance their initiatives, whether it's how you serve at ASU or how to use research to get new results? And any great examples going on at ASU that might give inspiration to cities around the world?
You know, so the weird thing is that most people that attend universities, which would be most city managers, most leaders, most agency heads, most technical people that work for cities, counties, and so forth, they all have college degrees. And then they were partly ruined by going to their college because they don't really understand their college, but they think they do. And so the key is to sit down with the problem set that you're working toward, and then don't go into a single department of the university or a single unit of the university. Try to get the entire university to sit and respond to you and say, well, we'd like to tackle the issues of homelessness or nighttime heat index or particulate matter elimination in this metroplex, or managing the airshed, managing the watershed, you know, managing the roads, rethinking this, rethinking that. And so the key is nearly everything that's involved in running a city is socio-technical, meaning it's not social only and it's not technical only. And so in socio-technical areas, you want to get as broad a swath of connection as possible with the university or the college. And you want to do that in a way by posing problems and posing challenges and then finding ways to work together. I mean, it's really sad that most agencies don't have research laboratories. Most agencies don't have universities attached to them, and most groups haven't found ways to come together to be attached. And so I keep saying to people all the time, I've said to a number of mayors, I've said to some others, think of us as your university, that you just call us up. I need this. I need this. I need this. I need this training. I need this learning. I need this problem solving. I need people from these 15 disciplines. I need every thought that you have on how to, reduce police shootings of people that are mentally unstable. How do we work on that? What are all the things that we could do? And then you start working together. And most government administrators are so focused on trying to deliver the service or solve the problem, they don't realize that sometimes you have to innovate or you're never going to be able to solve it. Think of all the things that look like they're unsolvable. They're unsolvable. Their unsolvability is a falsehood. Anything is solvable. Anything is solvable. You can solve all of these things. You just have to work at it in a different way. So the way is to try to engage. What I would do is I would set up a liaison between the city and the university, which we've done it with a few cities here, and then work on getting these problems on the table all the time and constantly.
Yeah, you're right. I don't think cities do a good enough job at engaging the university and accessing all the innovation, all the talent, all the, you know, the brain power that goes on.
I hear this all the time. Well, you know, I talked to Professor X and he wasn't interested. I guess you guys are not interested. You know, I talked to the head of the whatever department and then he left. And so universities are really weird places. You know, we have 200 departments in schools. We have 16 colleges. We have 5,000 faculty members. So what you want to do is you want to engage the institution, and then the institution will deliver the resources that are needed from the institution.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, one of the major challenges that a lot of cities and city managers, mayors are talking about today is workforce development. So tell us, you know, your approach to workforce development and be sure to highlight the learning enterprise. You know, what advice do you have for city, both in regards to their own workforce upskilling, but as well as the residents?
Yeah, so here's what's happened. So technology has enabled ASU now to operate in three modalities simultaneously. One, greatly enhanced on-campus learning for anyone that can make their way over here. Highly technologically advanced, very enhanced, very successful. Two, we've been able to take those same degrees, 300 of them, give or take, and we're making those available to anyone, anywhere, anytime, any scale, period. Just think about that. We didn't have that before. So if a city says, I wish I had more, whatever, engineering capability, or I wish I had more accounting capability, or I wish I had this or this or this or this, that's all available. And then under what we now call the ASU Learning Enterprise, we now view a person in a different way. We think the university has a responsibility to be available to any, what we call universal learner, any learner anywhere at any stage of their life with whatever they need. So we're building thousands upon thousands upon thousands of other learning assets in addition to our traditional academic assets. And we're trying to make all of those available technologically. And we're off to a great start in that. It's going pretty well. And we're very excited about that.
And how do you think cities should lean into that? Like where should they invest to get the results for their citizens or their employees? Like just by giving them the options and pointing them to ASU, or is there something the city should do to take action to change their trajectory for workforce development?
Oh, the cities have to change their action. So let's just take a company that we've been working with. We've been working with Starbucks. They have hundreds of thousands of employees. We've graduated 7,000 of their employees from ASU. We have 18,000 of their employees as students. We have trained 35,000 Starbucks employees. They're called partners in sustainability. We have hundreds of thousands of family members of Starbucks who are engaged in learning assets that we've built and developed through our global learning platform that we have. And so cities could be working with the university to educate people on, you know, why you need to plant more trees, or how you could use your water, or so you can't just assume that, you know, or you know, how do you react in a great pandemic? How do we work together to improve our neighborhoods? There's ways to educate people, train people, bring them up. There's ways to have cities respond to their own workforce complexities. How do you retain city workers? How do you keep city workers moving for decades and decades and enhance their education along the way? So cities in general do not see themselves as learning institutions. And in general, they don't see themselves as needing to also create a learning environment for their citizens. And so mostly they complain. And so what I mean is they complain, well, we can't get people to understand this, or we can't get, you know, we can't get more support for what we should be doing in the parks, or we can't get more people out walking, or we can't do this, or we can't do that. And so that's because, you know, we give up on that stuff. And so cities can produce any learning environment that they want to. They just need to work with somebody that does that, like ASU.
That's amazing. You know, you referenced earlier that technology, the investments in technology are helping some of these things come to life and helping scale. At the same time, you referenced many of these industries that aren't evolving with innovation, that kind of stuck. And I'm just curious if there's some advice. I know you've invested a lot in IT as a function at ASU to help scale, to help become an enterprise. And how might a city look at that IT to think about how they can scale and get different outcomes too?
Well, so it was kind of funny. In 1996, I remember I held this meeting at Columbia University when I was a faculty member there and chief research officer. And I was dealing with these fools on the faculty who told me that the internet was a fad. And I said to them, I said, do you think the book is a fad? Do you think electricity is a fad? Because the internet, which is still young and we're having struggling with all kinds of problems and so forth and so on, it isn't a fad. It's equal to electricity and the book together. And even beyond that, it is probably the most significant tool that we've ever seen. And so for informing people and educating people and moving people forward and also ultimately doing work. And so it turns out that the cities who become the most technologically capable, the most technologically agile, will be the winners over and over and over. And the rate at which they win and the speed at which they win and the pain that will go to the losers in this new environment and this new economy is going to be very significant. And so we need ubiquitous access to high-speed internet, period. We need to start worrying about not how do we just build factories here, but how do we build distributed manufacturing? You know, one of the ideas that I talked about with some colleagues when we were in the middle of the pandemic and all the restaurants were shutting down, well, restaurants are basically chemical engineering plants where they convert one form of chemicals to another form of chemicals by restructuring the proteins and the flavors and so forth and so on. Well, that means that everybody that works there is a technician at least and an engineer in many cases. Well, what else could they make? What else could they manufacture? So how do you take and distribute through 3D printing and this and this and this, all things related to manufacturing? Well, you could do almost anything if we just rethink this. So for local communities, if they build the right infrastructure, if they design the right infrastructure, if they build the right systems, they could attract more companies to their towns. The workforce could become distributed. People wouldn't have to commute 50 miles to some downtown place for some kind of job. They could work more often at home, walk over to the place where their neighborhood manufacturing 3D support system was built. They had, you know, it's just amazing. They have access to all kinds of things. And so what we have to get people thinking about at the city level is how do you underpin all of this technologically?
So I'm glad that you were talking some sense in Columbia and that the internet wasn't a fad. Have you invested in CryptoKitties?
You know, the whole thing about crypto, I mean, the thing that we've got to get people to understand about crypto and all things crypto, not just CryptoKitties, but cryptocurrency, you know, all these other things that are happening is, you know, once we bring order to all of this, these are all new opportunities.
Exactly.
And so what will happen at some point is that there's going to be huge opportunities for crypto, for instance, in perhaps becoming an asset that's produced as a part of balancing the carbon in the atmosphere. There's going to be ways in which carbon is going to have value and there's going to be currencies and other kinds of currencies and ways in which they're extracted. And so people need to resist this stuff about holding everything back to a single pathway. Crypto is not going to be, you know, the elimination of the dollar or the currency. It's going to be a new currency. It's going to be a new thing, a new way to move forward. And these new ways then empower and enable new things. I'll use carbon, for instance. And so in the infrastructure bill that was just passed by Congress last week, there are four regional hubs for the capture of carbon from the atmosphere. How can you capture that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere? Well, that means you're going to put a value on that. Once you put a value on that, there's going to be a whole new economy emerge. You're going to be trading carbon, producing carbon. You're going to be mining carbon from the atmosphere to use in the manufacturing of photon, water, and carbon dioxide driven energy systems. You're going to be producing things by taking the bad thing out of the atmosphere, adding value to it. Well, you might have an entire cryptocurrency working on all those fronts. And so if you're in a city or a municipality or a county or a state that is backward with rigid old 19th century, 20th century laws and rules, you're not going to be a part of any of that. And so you've got to be able to look at all these technological platforms as a way in which the modern city can emerge.
I love it. I knew by joking you'd come up with a great answer. We do have two closing questions we ask of everyone as well. And one is just, how can we help to do more, whether it's us to open doors in cities, or if someone's listening and they can fulfill the request. We've really gotten some unique answers from this question. So I don't know, what are you trying to make happen at ASU that you know that you don't exactly have the line of sight to yet?
Well, you know, the one thing that's interesting to me is that most cities look at the university as kind of a sideshow, a side thing. The modern city hasn't then come out and said, well, let's plug into the ASUs of the world and they'll be our university and they'll worry about research and they'll worry about development and they'll worry about partnerships and they'll worry about learning systems and learning outcomes and they'll worry about, you know, getting our employees doing this and this and this. And so there, so we have a broken down thing. We're not really connected. So the cities are becoming more and more competitive, more and more technologically sophisticated, more and more challenges as we face an ever increasing and more complicated world. Yet the university is still a mystery to most of them, disconnected from most of them. And the university likewise is not really full throated in its way that it's found a way to engage with the cities. The Starbucks example is a way in which a major corporation and a major university, ASU and Starbucks, have come together. And out of that is coming all kinds of new things, just using that as an example. So one of the things that I hope for, that I wish for, is that people would say, well, if this is City X and this is ASU, here's what they look like together. Here's what we're doing together. Here's what we're able to achieve together. And we don't have that mindset yet. So people think about the university and they think about their kid, or they think about some jerk professor they had when they were an undergraduate, or they think about, you know, why did we lose to Washington State and then crush USC and you know, maybe keep ourselves out of the Rose Bowl. That's just like one aspect of what we're doing. That's a lot of fun, but every city should have its own university. Every city should have its own learning enterprise, and they can't build it. We already built it. And so they need to figure out how to make this happen. So Chris, that's something that I sort of wish for. I wish that we could do that.
Well, I'll tell you, just as an aside from yesterday, I was at a lunch downtown Phoenix at a place called The Big. And I was there with a person that just graduated in data science from ASU and had been working downtown for their PhD research for 4 or 5 years. Another person that was living in California had moved to Gilbert, but had lived in Arizona 15 years ago. And they were both stunned at what they've seen as ASU has been embedded in the Phoenix culture and how Phoenix itself as a city is changing rapidly. And my guess is a lot of that is plugging in and getting embedded with a lot of these principles.
Well, yeah, it's not like we're not doing anything. It's just that I think that we could do a lot more. So,
right?
Yeah, completely.
Right. All right. Well, love the progress. Our last question is just, is there anyone that you're particularly appreciative that's helped you along your way? And as you've gotten to know the urban complex and us, if you think they'd be a great guest on the show, we'd love to know. So,
well, let's see. Well, I mean, so I'm so old that most of my mentors are dead, and so I had a series of mentors. Literally, I had a series of mentors born in the 1910s.
Well,
you know, who then were old guys and who really took me under their wing, and so they're all dead. You know, I think people that you might talk to.
So we need a seance?
No. I mean, you want to talk to people that are making stuff happen. You know, you want to talk to companies that are making stuff happen. You want to talk to people that are trying to do new things, people that are breaking out of the system. And so Chris, I can think about some of those names for you to get on this show. But it's really, and anybody that's just sort of running something, you got really no reason to talk to them. I even have this little joke I say to people sometimes. I said, you know, if I can ask you a question, and then as I ask you the question, if I write down the answer that I think you're going to give me, and then you do that to me 3 times in a row, then I have no reason to ever talk to you again. Because I'm not talking to you to get an answer that I already know that you can produce. So what you're after is, what you want is, you know, there are people conceptualizing cities around the world right now, you know, that as unbelievable things, completely integrated systems, planning new cities, planning new clusters of cities, planning new regions, You know, I think you need to get more people in from places that are trying to do that in the Netherlands, some places in the Middle East, in Singapore. Just take economic development, for instance. You know, I was down in Singapore a few years ago, and you go down there to the Economic Development Board. They call it the EDB. And so every person I met with spoke five languages. You know, and so you'd be meeting with, you know, Mr. Tan or Miss Tan. That was a common name there. And they'd say, well, yes, I got my master's in chemical engineering at MIT and my graduate specialization in economic development. And I speak 14 Asian and European languages. And then they're operating on a global scale. So what one needs in all of this is to just open up everyone's horizon by bringing in people that are making things. Like, how is it that, you know, in 1945, at the end of World War II, in Seoul, Korea, they were eating, you know, anything that walked because they were starving. And in, you know, Singapore, there was, it was just unbelievable devastation. And now they're two of the leading economies in the world. And people don't even know what they did or what they went through or what they built or how they got there. And then how they're eating our lunch sometimes. And I think that those would be great people to bring in. And I do know some of those people, so we could talk about some of them.
Love it. I mean, I doubt you listened to our intro session in January, but you kind of hit the nail on the head of what the urban complex is meant to be. We're trying to give inspiration and bring those that are changing the status quo and making great things happen. So I guess we just say thanks. With that, the urban complex gives a big note of thanks to today's guest, Dr. Michael Crow, president of Arizona State University. Thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
The Greater Phoenix Economic Council, known as GPEC, was named the top economic development organization in the U.S. in 2020. As a data-driven regional organization, GPEC serves as a strategic partner to companies across the world as they expand or relocate to other markets. Over the past 31 years, GPEC has fueled the Greater Phoenix economy by helping more than 850 companies and creating more than 154,000 jobs. Leaders in Greater Phoenix are building the nation's most innovative and connected smart region through The Connective. This community-driven applied research model deploys technology at scale. For more information about GPEC, visit gpec.org.
All right, Don. Well, that was Michael Crow. What do you think?
We knew it was going to be fantastic, and it was. I mean, just what great advice that he provided to a lot of our city listeners. I mean,
if really you're not excited after listening to that, you're like one of his 1910 mentors. You're dead.
Exactly. It was just fantastic. You know, what really stuck out to me are kind of two things that I want to hit on is, you know, his focus around public-private partnerships or building partnerships to help drive future of cities and the future of innovation. I mean, what he's done in creating those pockets, those areas, whether it's in downtown Phoenix, Skysong, Novus, and Tempe, he's focused directly on the partnerships to advance innovation, to advance the economy, and to build new industries.
That's the thing. It's like they know the industry they want to advance, and so they start with that vision and that core, and they spread the seeds, and then they sprinkle, and they add research to it, and they get companies to come, and they create the space, and then they get the cities involved, and not necessarily in that order. But yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, and just that focus on, I mean, partnerships was kind of, he said it over and over and over, how important partnerships are, not only for the university, but for the future of cities. And I mean, ASU is a perfect example of what can happen when you partner well. So I thought that was fantastic. And last piece, I mean, I think his advice of cities reaching out to universities and proactively partnering better with universities and leveraging all the resources, the knowledge, the innovation that is happening on campus to help solve challenges that the cities are facing. I thought that was a great
in a holistic manner, right? He said, bring us your problems, bring us your challenges, not the point solution, but not the point issue, but actual, the broad brush, and say, and let us know. And we can kind of look across that spectrum. And, you know, his Rio Salado example was amazing. I mean, that used to be what, a dry creek bed that maybe, you know, flash flood, you'd get some water in it, you know, a couple times a year, maybe. Now it's this amazing location that people go and windsurf on and boat on and paddleboard on, but yet it's created these riparian sections for birds and now they're going to extend it from the 4 or 5 miles it is today for 40 miles and connect Tempe to downtown Phoenix. And like, I mean, that is something where we've heard it before. You think big, but you start small, but you look holistically along the way. it seems harder work, but you actually get better results when you do that. And, you know, what do you say? Like, you tell us, you want 15 students to solve this array of problems. Great. You need this research. But yet the old way people do it is they went to their friend's professor. And that, I mean, ASU has thousands of professors. That one person you know doesn't necessarily know how to navigate the university. So it's finding that contact, as he said, the liaison, and go to the president. Like, you want to work with Michael Crow? You know, hate to put words in his mouth, but I know how he operates. You send him an email directly. You know, it's public record what his email is. He'll find the person to be the liaison to represent what you want to do. He's very responsive that way, and he means it.
Yeah,
I mean, the thing that stuck. Well, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, yeah, I thought that was such a great call out from him. Is like, plug your city into the university. Every city should have a university. Every city should have a learning enterprise. I was like, it's just so
not,
true.
Not a check mark. Yeah, no. I can see my university over there. No. It's your design partner. It's your thought partner. They always say at ASU, knowledge is at the core, and that's what it is. Like, and so the way they build the knowledge is they get these amazing research asks, whether it's from industry, whether it's from a city or wherever it is. And those things he was talking about, like homelessness and urban heat and canopy coverage of cities to get right walking. Like, people walk downtown Phoenix in the summers because of investments they've made in research and putting more tree coverage there. It's they did the research to do it. They came with their challenges. So, yeah, I think the one thing that you didn't hit on that was amazing to me, that stuck out, was that thought of design and embedding design into change. And it starts with the willingness to experiment. We've heard that time again from others. But I think his call to action, if you're just running your city the same way, you're going to find yourself treading water at best, but most likely you're going to be falling behind. Those that have an innovation culture, those that are getting technological advances, those that are embedding that socio-technology mindset and getting the ideas from wherever they can get them and going to their university as a partner and embedding technology that scales, there's going to be big winners. And the winners of the past aren't necessarily going to be the winners of this next generation. And I wasn't joking. Like, it got me excited, and I'm not a city leader. We just know we're passionate about the space. And hopefully, if you're listening, you know, these things are real. Like, the opportunity is now. We need great leadership.
Yep.
And again, back to this podcast, if you've got great stories, we'd love to help get them out there. So,
yeah, such a great point that you just made. And, you know, ultimately it's like, why can't a city go to a university and partner like Starbucks did with ASU? You can, right? Those types of innovative partnerships can happen between cities and universities. And I think,
again, the workforce in a city needs to modernize. And so why wouldn't you think about becoming a knowledge entity for your citizen, for your employee? Secondarily, for your citizen, imagine if you redirected some of those tax dollars to kind of help solve a challenge or two as well. Find out what they want to learn. And, you know, I don't know. It was very inspiring. So,
yep. Great. It was fantastic to have him on. We were definitely lucky to have him on. So let's pivot to cracks in the pavement. What do you got for us this week?
Well, it's funny, in line with one of the things Dr. Crow said around technology is that the right tech paired with that socio-technology kind of viewpoint is going to scale. It's funny that one of the articles today says smart city evolution, how cities have stepped back from a tech arms race. As I read through it, there's like five or six of our former guests in here too, like Jan Sanders, Deborah Lamb, Karen Lightman. I'm sure I'm skipping a few, but what the article's about is just the original tech that was focused on the tech. We've heard this time and time again. Is petering out. Although I want to make sure people realize, like what Dr. Crow is saying, you got to find the right fit, and it's got to be a holistic fit. So things like the sidewalk labs, where it's just pure tech, let the tech company go. I think what they're saying is it's that going from tech centricity to the citizen centricity that we've heard many talk about, building that holistic view so that the tech actually works and actually solves the problem that was intended to solve.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely makes sense what they're saying in this article about, you know, it's shifted to a more resident focused approach, which, you know, ultimately we've said it from the very beginning, and all of our guests have kind of said it too. It's, it's not tech for tech's sake, right? The technology is the means of solving the challenges that you're facing, your residents are facing, your businesses are facing. So I definitely agree with the article, but you're exactly right too. And I think Dr. Crow mentioned this, is you still need to invest and build the technology infrastructure that's going to enable you to scale or be agile or really innovate in order to solve these challenges. So you can't not just dismiss technology completely.
Right. Well, you gotta know what is unique, what challenges are unique to your city, and how do you holistically define that problem, and how do you let the assets that are part of your city ecosystem. That was another thing Dr. Crow said, is like, cities don't realize how broad their ecosystem is. Yeah. They're looking at the things they manage, not necessarily the whole scope. And so, if you can tap into that to get the right the right problems asked, get the ideas sourced, kind of like Mitchell Weiss's book on We the Possibility, like crowdsource that stuff, get it out there, go partner with your university, go solve it, and create the technology that's going to change your world, you're going to find that stuff scales. And I think that's what this is saying, is that it's shifting to really problem-centric, understanding the needs of the resident and changing their trajectory.
Yeah, it's a great article. I think it's perfectly aligned with kind of the conversation we just had with Dr. Crow. So great.
Love the fact that the partnership that you helped architect is referenced in there too. Nice work.
Yeah, the National Smart Coalition Partnership. Yeah, it's great.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks all. That's a wrap. Until next week.
See you later.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Urban Complex, Smarter Cities for a Stronger Tomorrow. Please find us on where you listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. We do love your feedback. Let us know if you have ideas for guests or questions to air on Cracks in the Pavement via social media. The Urban Complex is found on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Or just shoot me an email, chris@theurbancomplex.com. Till next time.